Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks so much for joining me today. My interview today is with an active duty police officer, John Fulbrecht, who has started a pretty amazing organization called 53 Hours. And it aids law enforcement officers who are in need. 53 Hours is an interesting name, and the reason for it is because every 53 hours, a police officer is killed in the line of duty. Let's step into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The briefing room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
Generally speaking, for the last few episodes, my view from the blue has really had some topics that are pretty strong. We talked about police suicide. We talked about the war on cops. We've talked about a lot of the negativity that has been occurring towards policing. And although all of that is true, I'm noticing something. Maybe it's my ever hopeful attitude, but to tell you the truth, I'm seeing a light at the end of this tunnel. I'm seeing a respect level returning to policing that I'm really heartened to see. There was an incident that happened just a few days ago in a Red Robin restaurant, and what happened was a group of about nine police officers had gathered in the Red Robin after the funeral of Columbus SWAT officer Stephen Smith, and their mood was, you know, horrendous because they just buried a comrade, and of course that's been happening way too much all over this country. Well, the food server in this Polaris, Ohio restaurant, Jessica Dunbar, who herself is the daughter of a retired cop, saw what was taking place and could feel the mood of the officers, and after some conversation realized why they were gathered. And at the end of the meal, this young woman told these officers that she understood what they were going through and she wanted to buy them lunch. You know, this has been happening more and more in America, and it is my belief that this is kind of the backlash from all of the negativity. I think we are seeing something that's really important. I think we're seeing the turning of the tide of the anti-police sentiment. And let me give you another reason for that. You know, with the war on cops, I've spoken about it and written about it extensively. And the war on cops, to me, is much more than just the physical attacks that take place. It's been the prevalent attitude in the media focusing on nothing but negative stuff. It's been the lies told by activists, by preachers, by people that are trying to get attention, and the media has been eating it up and regurgitating, and it's just been causing a terrible situation for American law enforcement. That's part of the war. There are other aspects of it as well. For instance, there's lawmakers who have been making it easier to prosecute police officers. There's really an assault on the First Amendment rights of cops, especially in regards to social media. They basically can't say anything without fear of retribution by their police agencies. So that's all part of the war on cops. It's not just the physical aspects. But now I'm seeing something that I've never seen before, and that is the beginnings of huge support groups for law enforcement. You know, I don't ever remember a major support group before all of this nonsense has taken place since Ferguson. But now, some grassroots efforts are beginning to really play a role. For instance, an organization that I am associated with is Blue Lives Matter. And Blue Lives Matter started out as a grassroots effort by some police families to combat all of the negative stuff on Facebook and social media by creating their own Facebook page called Blue Lives Matter. And the growth of this, and it's just simply grassroots. They don't do any advertising. They don't do any anything to bring people onto this. They just talk. They speak the truth about policing. And they now have 650,000 followers, 24,000 followers this week alone. Well, this is amazing. Another organization, one that, in fact, my guest today, who began this police support page, it's 53 Hours is what it's called, they have over 100,000 people that follow them. You add a few of the others that are out there, LESMA, the Law Enforcement Supporters for Media Accountability. They have a tremendous amount of followers. I do not believe that this would have happened had it not been for all of the nonsense and all the lies and the negativity and the attacks against law enforcement. So here's what's happening, in my estimation. All of the war on police has now spurred action by those people who have in previous times been called the silent majority. And it's brought them to a point where they want to show their support for the American police officer. And we're seeing that now. And that's an unintended consequence that I think all of the anti-police forces did not intend to see. They thought that they were going to create an uprising against the police. And in certain neighborhoods and in certain areas of the country, they were successful. But now we're seeing the American people rise up in a different way. And not the way that of course, the negative groups have with loud protests and violent confrontations. One of my guests a couple shows ago was Kelly Wintz, who was married to a police officer, and she organized a march in support of law enforcement on Washington, D.C. that drew over 1,000 people. So we are seeing now the real America begin standing up for their law enforcement and showing their support by participating in these Facebook pages like Blue Lives Matter, 53 Hours, and others like that. So, in essence, I think that we're going to be okay. I think that law enforcement is going to get through this. We're going to have some pain still in the future, and we're going to have some long-term effects because of the very nature of the damage that has been done to police departments and police agencies and the morale of cops all over the country. But I think we're going to emerge, and we're going to emerge stronger, and we will continue to battle for the people that we serve and that we protect. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue. Today, I have a very special guest. His name is John Fulbright. He is an 11-year veteran deputy sheriff in Martin County, Florida, and he's the founder and leader of the Heroes Memorial Foundation. That's a nationwide nonprofit with the mission of helping emergency responders overcome extreme situations, also known as Heroes. The Heroes Memorial Foundation manages the popular Facebook page 53 Hours, that reports news about law enforcement and corrections heroes. Now, John is an active law enforcement corrections adjunct instructor at the Indian River State College with multiple instructor certifications. He's also a U.S. Army veteran, and he was earned the rank of specialist, was awarded the Army Good Conduct Medal, Outstanding Volunteer Award, Army Service Ribbon, Army Parachutist Badge, and Army Parachute Rigger Badge. And he received his honorable discharge from the United States Army in 2002. So, welcome to the show, John. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Randy. I appreciate you having me.
You know, the Heroes Foundation, explain to the listeners just what you guys do, and then we'll talk a little bit about the impact it's having on our first responders.
Well, Heroes, it stands for Emergency Responders, See Responders Overcome Extreme Situations. I came up with that acronym about a year and a half ago. It took a while to come up with it. And I wanted something that related to all of the branches of public safety, to include law enforcement, corrections, EMS, fire, and also our military service members. Because even though they may not be here on the home front, they are what we consider emergency responders, just like, you know, the police and the fire. And then a lot of times our military are representing police or fire services abroad. So we wanted to make sure that we touched base on all of those categories. And basically what we do is anything and everything that we can to help these heroes. Whether they got hurt on duty or off duty, it doesn't matter. We want to make sure that we're going above and beyond to take care of our nation's heroes, because the rhetoric that's going around our country right now through the media and so on is extremely negative, and it's our mission to make sure that we try and change that.
Well, when you say, I couldn't agree more, of course, about all the insane rhetoric that's been going on about law enforcement, but how does your organization work? How do you reach out to first responders and touch them?
Well, we have a multitude of social media venues. One of our more popular pages is called 53 Hours. And we derived that name from the 2011 statistics that the FBI put out, that on roughly every 53 hours, a law enforcement officer is killed in the line of duty. And we took that name so we could take and give some significance to our viewers and have them understand that, you know, almost every 2 days, there's an officer that's dying. Now, that might not be the actual case. What we're talking about here is more along the lines of how many officers died throughout the year, and you calculate that out and divide it by the amount of hours, and that's where they come up with the 53-hour term. Our viewers view the news that we find throughout multitudes of other media venues, and we consolidate all of that news into our website so that it's easily found. We are considered one of the renowned breaking news sources for all law enforcement related news at this point. When people want to know what's going on, they come to our page and usually we find it. And with our team, we're able to reach out, communicate with the agencies just as the news does, but we're also, because we are first responders ourselves, we have an inside connection a lot of times where we get firsthand information well before the media ever does. We usually get names released to us prior to the media being, you know, receiving that information. So it gives us a little leeway in how we're able to do things. We create our online memorials for our websites, and a lot of times we have special memorial style graphics that also help facilitate the mourning process for our country.
That's biting off a big chunk, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it is. I actually consider telling people a lot of times that we are 911 for 911. If there is anything that we could possibly do, I make it a point that we try and accomplish it. And we do have a lot of multitude of things. With about 40 volunteers across the country, we're able to get what we are doing now accomplished. But I'll be honest with you, a lot of these folks, they're overwhelmed at times. There's a lot of news that's coming in, and it can be, you know, overwhelming. It really can, because there's just so much that's going on, and it's hard to try and keep up with it.
Well, are you looking for volunteers to help you now?
Oh, absolutely. We would love more volunteers to be able to come on and help us, especially with the news portion of our website. Just, you know, researching the information, making sure that it is the correct information. We also need folks that can reach out and talk to the agencies for us. Some of our other programs and stuff that we have is our American Heroes flags. That's three different American flags that were flown over the United States Capitol. They're codenamed Justice, Liberty, and Freedom. And those three flags, they go to funerals across the country. And so it's imperative that we have volunteers throughout every state to help facilitate the transportation of those flags.
That's interesting. Can you explain to me more about that?
Well, the American Heroes flags, we got the idea because the common U.S. honor flag is, you know, it's been traveling around the United States. But the only problem with it is that it's just one flag. So my idea was that if I could take and I could have a flag that has been to the funeral of a multitude of different heroes, then it has a semblance of uniting each of those families together, that flag has traveled from one funeral to another funeral to another funeral. And we also utilize it to take and, you know, help support a wounded hero. You know, maybe they're recovering in the hospital from a gunshot wound. You know, we've sent the flag so that they can be there by their side. It's more of a semblance of unity than anything else, trying to unite all of the heroes and their families together as one so that they can all, you know, heal and mourn together.
Well, that's really interesting. Did when you send that flag, does it come with someone from your organization that displays it? Is that how it works?
No, we take them, we send the flag any possible way. A lot of times it's commercial, like FedEx or UPS or something along those lines. So it does cost money to ship the flag. Now, the interesting thing is that each flag has its own Pelican case that it ships in. And inside that Pelican case, along with the flag, is a journal or a record log that travels with the flag. And every time it is picked up by an officer or an agency, and even when it is shipped out, the logbook is completed to indicate that it was on a mission to go and honor or be with a particular hero, and that's categorized inside of that particular logbook for each flag.
That's amazing. That's got to really have a tremendous emotional impact on the families.
Yeah, I believe it does. I've had several families that have contacted us and thanked us for having the flag sent to their loved one's funeral. We've had the flags requested already for several events upcoming this year. We have some, it's not law enforcement, it's the fire memorial service coming up in Huntsville, Alabama. They're going to be doing their own there locally, and they've requested the delivery. A Liberty flag will be sent there.
That's great. Do the people that you are who want them to volunteer, what kind of skills do they need to have?
Well, I would hope that they have some social media skills, just an idea, navigational way around Facebook, Twitter, you know, something along those lines just to get you started. You don't really have to have any particular type of skills that we're looking for. We do provide training so that you take and, you know, you learn the way and the style of how we take and we manage and operate everything that we do. There is a multitude of different facets that people take and they fall into. Some folks enjoy the public information officer position, which is you directly dealing with the agencies and the families. You're also dealing with some of the media, trying to get our events and stuff published out. Some folks like just being the researcher or the person that's finding the news, and that's the extent that they're willing to go. While as others, you know, they take on a lot more roles where they're more interactive in the organization and possibly even into the leadership.
So this is really, in essence, a big grassroots effort that is organized by you and your organization, and then it brings in people who are just good citizens from around the country. Is that correct?
That's correct. And our leadership is comprised of all first responders. Myself, an active law enforcement officer, my wife is on the board as well. She's a active law enforcement officer. She works as a school resource officer. My second in command is a law enforcement officer for the city of Stewart. The person who's the chief of 53 hours, he's a law enforcement officer for Stewart as well. Our fire chief that runs our last alarm page is an active firefighter paramedic. And then the person who runs our Gold Star Warrior section is a retired senior chief from the Navy. So they've all had a interaction into the specific group that they manage. And we've structured it in such a way as so that it is easily recognizable by all of us that work, you know, in public safety and in the military to have that paramilitary style structure.
Did when you talk about the paramilitary structure, this is an all-volunteer organization, correct?
That is correct.
And how are you funded?
Well, we're funded a lot of times by my own tuition, basically. I've been putting a lot of my own money into this thing, you know, my overtime, the money that I get from teaching, just to pay for, you know, a lot of the basic things that we need, because just because we're a nonprofit doesn't mean that we get things for free a lot of times. The other things that we do is we operate our online store. We sell t-shirts and stickers and the blue silicone bracelets and you know, things like that. So we do that. We also request donations online, and a lot of times people take and they help us out. One of the things that makes us different as far as fundraising goes is that a lot of nonprofits operate with the intention of the amount of money that they derive, a certain percentage becomes their administrative fee in order to pay for, you know, their operational cost, i.e. a salary. Well, currently nobody at Heroes Memorial Foundation draws any type of a salary, so we don't have any need for that. And by me paying for a lot of the operational costs out of my own pocket, I don't have a need for that administrative fee either. So anything that we take and we do fundraising-wise for a hero, all of that money goes to that hero.
So give me a for instance. You get notified that an officer has been injured in the line of duty. Say a coworker contacts you and asks you for whatever assistance you can give. Is that generally the way that that the mechanics work?
For the most part, yes. The only thing that would not happen is that we do not do any fundraising unless we are requested to do so by either the family or the agency. A lot of times there are some organizations out there, they immediately start a fundraiser. We don't do that. We want to make sure that we abide by whatever the agency and the policy or the family puts out, because that's important to us. We're here to support them. First and foremost, we want to make sure that they take and they have the opportunity to make all the right choices that they want to do. But we do offer all of our services that are available. In many cases, sometimes we have been the immediate liaison between the family and the media. That's happened quite a few times. One of the interesting things about us is that not only do we do things that are for active law enforcement or first responders, but even like the sick children, those that might have cancer, like leukemia and things like that, that are created as honorary officers or honorary firefighters, we do things for them as well.
Well, that's amazing. So give me a for instance. Say that I contact you because my partner has been shot and he's recuperating in the hospital. Just what would you offer as in terms of support?
Well, I could offer a direct donation, crowdfunding that's similar to GoFundMe, but with less fees. Another option would be to do t-shirt sales, vehicle decals that, you know, support the officer being injured. We could also take and coordinate, like I've done in the past, an actual physical concert. You know, we have musicians come out and, you know, people come out and they sponsor the concert, and, you know, we sell tickets for the concert. It's a huge fundraiser. We can take them, we can do a multitude of different things. The easiest thing is the t-shirt and the vehicle decals. You know, those are simple because a lot of times I create those specific graphics that we would utilize for that fundraising effort.
Wait, give me an estimate, if you would, of the number of people that you've reached out and helped over the last few years since you began this amazing program.
To be honest with you, it'd probably be right around the number of 30 that we've actually done fundraising for. There are some other folks that we've done things for that it didn't result in an actual fundraiser, but we might have done other things. We might have helped them with graphics that helped them do their own style of fundraising, things like that.
Are there any particular cases that really had a tremendous emotional impact on you?
Yeah, there was one. We did a fundraising and a Facebook page and stuff for a little boy named Aiden Rydell. And Aiden had leukemia. He was 7 years old when his mom and his aunt first reached out to us. And he was made an honorary firefighter in the town that he lived in Washington Township, New Jersey. And we immediately started, you know, working on ways of how it is that we're going to take and we're going to get attention brought to Aiden. So we came up with the idea of making Aiden your like honorary firefighter for the day at your house, at your firehouse, and to write his name on your roster so that he was technically riding with you. Even though he wasn't there, he was still on your roster. And these firefighters from all around the world, I mean, we had, it was like over 100 countries that had sent us different photos.
Wow.
Of his name on their particular roster. You know, a lot of them come out of like Australia, but some of the other countries and stuff. But, you know, even the stuff that was here, we had the crew, or the cast and the crew from Chicago Fire that plays on TV.
Yeah.
They did a video for him, you know, holding the t-shirts that we had made. You know, saying we love you, Aiden. It was a really great thing, and we worked real hard. We raised almost $14,000 for him because his mom's, you know, a single mom. She's got two boys, Aiden's brother Max. So, you know, we were trying our best. I mean, that was like our main mission at that moment. And on December 10th, 2014, Aiden passed away. And I actually had to go up. I felt obligated to go to his funeral.
Sure.
So I did. I went to New Jersey and I stayed there overnight and went to the funeral. And the amount of camaraderie that goes on in a firehouse is one of the things that's always amazed me, to be honest with you. It's something that I had always dreamed would happen, you know, in law enforcement. You just get that good camaraderie, everybody is together. And when I got to Washington Township, New Jersey, one of the firefighters came and picked me up from the airport, got me settled in my hotel, and the next day they came and they picked me up, and I mean, they were fast, you know, I mean, just like, oh, everything was ready to go. And it was so planned and coordinated, and went to the firehouse where Aiden was given his honorary firefighter badge and, you know, his hat and stuff, and that whole place was nothing but a family. And, you know, I felt like they had brought me in and made me as part of their family as well, because they were so ecstatic over the amount of stuff that we had went through with them to make sure that we had raised all of these funds for Aiden and his family. And it was extremely emotional.
I bet it was.
Trying to maintain my composure during that was difficult because I also have three children myself.
Oh, I can imagine that must have been rough emotionally on you. And the and Aiden's mom, you interacted with her, I take it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she was extremely thankful. I met his grandparents, and they all knew me like they had known me for years, you know, and I know that they could only just see my picture on Facebook or something to that effect, but, you know, I talked to them on the phone and, you know, and all this stuff, and they were keeping us up to date, and, you know, so we were in preparation for Aiden to, you know, take on his angel wings, so to speak. but it didn't make it any easier.
No, I'm sure. Well, it sounds like you are doing some amazing work. So if someone wanted to volunteer for your organization, how would they go about contacting? Who would they contact and how?
Well, the simplest thing would be to go to our website, and that's www.goheroes.us. And underneath the About section is the list of volunteer positions that are currently open. We're always accepting applications. And like I said, we don't really have any type of specific skill set that we're looking for. I would prefer that the volunteer be over 18 years of age and out of high school would be the preferred thing, just because we're basically looking for somebody that's, you know, mature and responsible, that can take and manage, you know, tasks on their own.
Gotcha. Now, and how would people, you're a 501c3, so you're not profit, and anything is tax deductible, correct?
Correct.
How would they go about contributing to your organization?
Well, we've got several things that are currently set up. You can donate directly from our website at goheroes.us. There's a donation tab that's on the front page, also in the menu. We are located on GoFundMe, and we're also located on rallyup.com. Both of those are crowdfunding platforms, so you can donate there directly. You can also take, and while you're shopping on Amazon, you can go to smile.amazon.com and look up Heroes Memorial Foundation. And while you shop there, we'll get a portion of your sales. And then another option is the iGiving Network. The iGive Network. And it has a multitude of different retail stores that are online. They give a certain portion of their proceeds to nonprofits, and if you select Heroes Memorial Foundation as your nonprofit of choice, they'll donate as well.
Well, that's great. There's a lot of different ways there. Well, I really I appreciate you coming on the show today. I thank you for not only your service to law enforcement, but going so far above and beyond and making such a tremendous effort to touch the lives of first responders all over the United States. Thanks again for coming on the show, and best of luck to you, John.
I thank you, Randy. I really appreciate it.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
Welcome to Police Story, where each week I read the story of an active duty or a retired police officer. These stories can be fiction, nonfiction. Generally speaking, it's something from their career. And if you have a story that you would like me to read on the air, please submit it to me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. This story was submitted by Ken Dye, who is a former police officer, retired police officer, who is also a writer. It's entitled, Killers I Have Known. Ken, get up. It was my wife. Get up, the desk is on the phone. Okay, babe. I get up, stagger to the kitchen, and grab the phone lying on the counter. Yeah? Detective Dye, it's the operations desk. Yeah, what's up? You didn't call me to see how well I was sleeping. No, Ken, a Wellston copper has been killed, and they want the county police homicide unit to handle it. What's the location? It's on Delaware, just east of Page. We're calling your crew now. Got it. I'm en route. I heard the fading good luck before I hung up the phone. I threw some water on my face, dressed, probably had the wrong socks on, and said, see you, babe. I got into my car and headed for Wellston. Wellston, Missouri is a St. Louis suburb. The once prosperous, predominantly black community boasted a Penny's, Sears, and a well-patronized shopping area along the Page Boulevard. Now a mere shell of its former self. Middle-class black families looking for greener pastures departed the area. Who could blame them? Wellston had fallen on hard times for sure. Drugs, broken dreams, broken lives all added up to a town with a major crime problem. In this case, a well-known and respected police officer who's been a cop for many years. The town now is in the midst of a crime-infested wasteland of what it once was. How the times change. I snapped out of my musing. I concentrated on the radio traffic. I ran scenarios in my head, trying to think of the last murder we worked in Wellston. Little Chucky. The continuing drug wars added bodies to the area's homicide rate, probably out of the same set. The previous murder close to the current offense. I heard the radio crackle with ID and homicide cars on the way to the scene. By the time I arrived, the ID detectives roped the area off with yellow crime scene tape. I could see an unmarked police car parked at a 45-degree angle in the middle of Delaware Street, a gray, unmarked Buick. I gave the car a quick look and saw a bullet gouge in the left front quarter panel. Just south of the police car, on the east side of the street, a small store. Along the north side of the store, a crudely made ladder leaned against the wall. I took all of this in as I surveyed the area, wondering if a couple guys were attempting to knock off the little store and got jammed up. The store, Mr. Jean's, a small convenience store used by the neighborhood, not bigger than a 10 by 12 bedroom. Limited items, chips, sodas, cigarettes, a Pac-Man machine in the corner, not much. The store reflected the beaten and battered town of Wellston. Gene Taylor, the owner, a man of little means, he got by on crutches, result of an industrial accident that left him unable to walk. Geez, could it get any worse? Yeah, it can, and I was about to find out. One of the homicide detectives interviewed a Wellston cop. He said Sergeant Jesse Henderson, going south on Delaware, apparently saw something, angled his car in the roadway, and got shot. Not much to go on, but we better get moving. It's true the first 48 hours in a murder investigation are critical. Detectives must and do work the homicide cases hard during the first 48, often not returning home or getting home to get a clean sheet and apply heavy-duty deodorant, then back on the trail. The Wellston cops grabbed two suspects in the area. Good pinch, I thought. Who in the hell but someone involved in this thing would be hanging around here at 3 a.m.? The two chumps, well-known to area cops, T.J. Ross and Michael Penny, waited at the Wellston PD for interview. The rumors flew. The street cats, surmising the treatment of the two detained suspects, let the word go forth. Man, the police are beating T.J. and Michael. Cops broke their legs to get them to talk. One of the cops had a gun to his head. All not true. The youthful crowd had nothing to do but spin tales of what they thought might be occurring. T.J. Ross's father came to the Wellston Police Department to inquire about his son. By this time, I arrived and worked the interview of the two. I brought T.J. to the front counter and showed his dad that he wasn't harmed or beaten. When asked how he was being treated, T.J. responded, "I'm okay, Dad. Ain't nobody hitting me. I didn't do nothing. The hue and cry cops hear all the time. I didn't do nothing." As expected, we had seen these two before, in the Little Chucky murder. We couldn't make a case on that one. No one saw anything. Everyone seemed to be afflicted with temporary amnesia, a contagious and frequent condition, especially when it comes to witnessing a crime. We interviewed the two in separate rooms. I caught them in lies and misstatements during the conversation. Soon the stories became totally outlandish, accompanied by the usual lying and denying. T.J. Ross said, "I didn't have nothing to do with that man. I was washing my tennis shoes at 3 a.m., heard all the commotion, and went to see what was going on." Washing your tennis shoes at 3 a.m. Come on. During the early morning hours, after getting the ridiculous and constantly changing stories, the two suspects were transported to St. Louis County Police Headquarters for a more formal and intensified interrogation. We let them cool their heels in interview rooms, stark, forbidding, and intimidating. The two observed on closed-circuit monitors. T.J. went to sleep on the desk. Michael paced the small room. This is a troubled youth. The one more likely to tell us what the hell happened to cause a uniformed police officer to be shot in the middle of the street at 2 a.m. A question that demanded an answer, and I'm going to do everything within my power and the law to get to the truth. Then it happened. Michael Penny, a 16-year-old with no goals or direction other than when am I going to eat next and where am I going to sleep. He broke the case by laying out what the hell happened. TJ soon followed and backed up the truth about what occurred. Statements taken individually without the two being able to converse and concoct tales. Stories about limiting and minimizing their involvement. TJ and Michael were walking down Delaware to burglarize a store, Mr. Jean's. Headed south on Delaware Street to the Target property, TJ and Michael Penny came upon Mark Shores. He's standing on his front porch smoking a wax stick. A wax stick is a Sherman cigarette dipped in liquid PCP. The resulting combination of the illegal drugs and an already criminal thought process of the user make a dangerous combination. Additionally, Mark Shores on this particular evening carried a .357 revolver tucked into the front of his pants. Let's see. Liquid PCP, a weapon, and a criminal act about to be committed. Nothing good can come of this. Shores offered the two a hit off the stick. TJ accepted. Michael did not. Mark said he would act as a lookout and forced himself into the burglary about to be committed. The three went to the targeted location. TJ and Michael prepared to consummate the act. Shores, the lookout, standing on the west side of the street. Sergeant Henderson, driving without lights south on Delaware, apparently observed the two knuckleheads attempting to break into the store. He angled his car into the street and exited. Shores approached the officer from behind. Sergeant Henderson turned to his left only to be greeted by a .357 round to his heart. Sergeant Jesse Henderson, a 25-year veteran of the Wellston Police Department, died before his 6'2" frame hit the street. He had $2 in his pocket. The two burglars took off, Shores firing at them. One of the rounds put a gouge in the left front quarter panel of the police car. This being the indentation on the unmarked police car I observed earlier. TJ and Michael were later that Shores attempted to kill them. He didn't want any witnesses to him shooting and killing the police officer. Add to that his altered state via the liquid PCP. Vicious and evil, Shores had a reputation as a killer lacking remorse or a sense of guilt. Warrants were issued for TJ. Michael transferred to the Missouri Juvenile Correction Center. Not enough evidence to issue a warrant for Mark Shores at this point. Additional investigation and a more detailed description of the deadly activity resulted in the St. Louis County prosecuting attorney presenting the matter to a sitting grand jury. Michael Penny, with a court order, brought back to Clayton, Missouri, and the St. Louis County Justice Center to testify before the grand jury. Michael's a street kid. Left to his own devices, he slept where and when he could, ate whenever possible. Scruffy clothes, scruffy appearance. Like so many kids born into the single-parent home, he attended school sporadically. No direction from a parent or a role model. He resorted, as many do, to a criminal lifestyle. I and another detective picked him up at the state juvenile facility. He hardly looked the same as the scruffy, dirty kid I interviewed. He had a haircut, glasses, fresh clothes, even gained a few pounds. He looked exactly like Urkel from the TV show Family Matters. Frankly, I was impressed with the new look and the manners. Many people object to juvenile offenders being placed under state care. This is a perfect example of a kid with no direction or guidance being transformed into a productive youth. A sense of being. The other occupants of the facility reinforced the positive behavior of the other, something not seen in their short, sometimes violent lives. The three of us enjoyed a pleasant and enlightening conversation on the way to St. Louis. How he grew up in the shadow of his aging grandparents, well-intentioned but unable to control him. Michael stole cars, burglarized homes, used and sold a variety of drugs. At the grand jury, Michael recounted everyone's acts that fateful morning back in September 1981. One of the grand jurors asked Michael, "You didn't actually see Mr. Shores pull the trigger, did you?" Man, this kid watches way too much TV, I thought. In the words that can only be spoken by a street kid, Michael said, "I seen the fire jump from the gun." Shores, indicted immediately, tracked to a location in the city and taken into custody. During his time at the offices of the St. Louis County Police Detective Bureau, I had the opportunity to attempt to discuss the murder with the trigger man, Shores. I attempted to discuss the homicide. He had been advised by his attorney to exercise his right to remain silent. His violent lifestyle had cast a shadow upon his soul and turned his heart black. Shores had the eyes of a killer, cold, unrelenting. I then talked to him about his life, prefaced by the admonishment this conversation would have nothing to do with the murder of Sergeant Jesse Henderson. Shores opened up. He talked about his drug dealing activities, how he was shot 9 times after being set up for a big heroin sale. It became time to transfer him to the confinement center of the Justice Center. He became a pretrial detainee, not causing trouble, waiting for his court appearance. Time moved on. I became the deputy commander of the intelligence unit. I handed off the investigative files to another homicide detective. I almost didn't take the position in the intelligence unit. That case had become a part of me. It's like letting go of a child or a beloved dog. I wanted to keep my fingerprints on the case and see it to a successful conclusion. After a wait of 2 years, the special prosecutor assigned to the case refused to proceed to trial. I pleaded with this chicken shit to let 12 citizens, tried and true, make that judgment, but they fell on deaf ears. I might as well have been talking to a stump. I guess I was talking to a stump. Non-cop friends told me, if you only had better witnesses. Well, there's a saying among homicide cops, you don't pick your cases, and you damn sure don't pick your witnesses. Shores, released from custody, headed to Michigan. Following a fine tradition, got jammed up and sentenced to 50 years in the Michigan Department of Corrections. The Michigan Department of Corrections website indicated he would be eligible for parole in 2020. Something told me not to believe that. I even called the correctional facility in Michigan, spoke with the warden, and advised him that Shores is a cop killer. Fast forward 20 years. I'm sitting at my computer one fine Florida morning. Something in the back of my head told me to take a look at Mark Shores. I check STL Today crime section and on the online access of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I'm greeted with the story that Mark Shores has been sentenced by a federal judge to 40 years for distribution of heroin. I immediately called the cold case detective at the St. Louis County Police Department. Upon checking into the matter, he found out Shores got paroled in Missouri in 2009. He took up where he left off, got caught, and sentenced to 50 years. Let's see if this cop killer really does die in prison or is released to continue his criminal enterprise. I wouldn't be real surprised if he's back on the street at some point. Periodically, I check Shores' status with the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. He's currently in custody at the Herlong Federal Correctional Institute in California. Maybe one of these days I'll get out there and see if he'll talk to me. An old homicide cop trying to close an old case. My wife says I should let it go, and I ask, how can I? Homicide detectives have a case that stays with them, one that they wish they could have done something different. Could have. Should have. Have what? To this day, I wonder if there's something, anything, I could have done to put the shooter of Sergeant Jesse Henderson in custody for the rest of his life. Homicide detectives are funny that way. Plain what if? What if I had worked the case harder, gotten more actionable evidence? Anything, anything at all, that would put a final chapter into the life and death of a police officer who died with $2 in his pocket. May Sergeant Jesse Henderson of the Wellston, Missouri Police Department rest in peace. I did everything I could, brother.